Time for a whip around of big country. This week we're heading to the Kimberley coast of Western Australia, where pearl farmers are smiling as the harvest of the precious gems delivers some stunning results. We'll join home restoration enthusiasts learning tricks to keep historic houses in perfect nick, and we'll find out about the feral animal problem that many country communities are having to contend with on top of the drought.
We've got a crop in at the moment and the pigs are just smashing it. Our neighbour's got a little crop in and he said every day he can go down there and shot 180 pigs in the last 3 months off his crop. So they're just targeting anything that's green or alive, and then when it gets dry, of course, then they start to target the little animals and any eggs on the ground.
The damage done by feral pests and how one town has turned it into a unique community fundraiser, with a pig hunt bringing in money for the local school and boosting morale. That's coming up in the next half an hour. But first to an amazing story of survival. A koala named Wazza has astounded wildlife carers with a remarkable recovery after a run-in with a car on a busy highway.
Each day is busy at the Port Macquarie Koala Hospital on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. There's leaves to be collected, yards to be raked, and of course many koalas to be cared for. Hello, I'm Emma C. Ossian. I'm here at the hospital where staff and volunteers are even busier than usual. It's koala breeding season, which means the animals are on the move and more prone to being struck by cars or attacked by dogs.
We've had quite a few. We've got another one that's just come in this morning from Crescent Head. He was hit during the night. With motor vehicles and dog attacks and things like that, it's very difficult to pull them through because often they come in here with really advanced injuries, but we do what we can.
Shane Flanagan is the clinical director at the Koala Hospital and says more than a week ago she received word that a koala had been hit by a car on a busy highway and dragged along at high speed for several kilometres. The outlook was grim.
This koala was, how and when she got onto the Pacific Highway, I don't know, but was on the highway just south of Fredericton, got hit. The gentleman apparently, I'm not sure whether he knew he'd hit her or not, but the koala ended up in the grill of the car and was dragged 10 kilometres along the highway with the back legs, at, you know, what was it, 110 or whatever, and he pulled up in Fredericton and the koala hopped out and climbed up the tree. Gobsmacked. I mean, I expected when the koala was being brought to us to find horrific injuries. I mean, I've seen drag injuries with koalas and it's awful. But when we got the koala out and started to deal with it, it wasn't anywhere near as bad as we thought. They were, you know, what you'd call pretty bad gravel rash and wasn't down to the bone or anything. It took off skin in a lot of places and a bit of bare muscle showing, but no tendons exposed or anything. It could have been horrific. There could have been no feet at all. Koalas, kangaroos, all sorts of animals, when they've been hit and they're in pain and in fear, they get this great rush of, you know, sort of stress hormones and adrenaline. And I've seen animals with broken legs, you know, take off. So that could have driven the koala up the tree, just the sheer fear. I mean, why wouldn't you be in fear when you've just been dragged along the Pacific Highway?
Oh, incredible. What happened after that?
Well, they called us immediately and we sent a team up. Here she is, and we didn't know what sex it was, but they wanted either direction. It had to be called Wazza. So it's a female and it's Wazza.
The Koala Hospital's assistant clinical director, Scott Castle, says the young koala has surprised them all.
It's always a surprise to see what they can go through and survive. And no severe damage to the head or brain or body, no ribs broken. And to just climb out of the radiator and run up a tree is great.
Wazza the koala has just had the bandages removed from her legs and feet and can now leave the intensive care unit to spend time in the Koala Hospital's outside yards.
These are tallowwood leaves and swamp mahogany leaves.
She's doing extremely well. She's a quiet little koala, very pretty little animal. She's only really young. She's only about a three-year-old. Big problem is what are we going to do with her? You know, there's not a lot of trees where she came from, so it's a bit of a difficult issue as for release, but we'll cross that bridge soon, I think. When we pick up a koala, when we do a capture, we put them back to the tree they came from. Obviously on a highway, you're not going to put them back beside the highway. But we try to put them back within, you know, 500 metres of their capture point because they have home ranges, that's where they live, that's where they belong. And if you try and put them anywhere away from their home ranges, they'll go back to them. And then they've got to run the gauntlet yet again of cars and traffic and fences and whatever.
Shane says drivers need to be on the lookout for koalas during the breeding season especially, with koala numbers already in serious decline in New South Wales and Queensland.
Oh, we're right bang smack in the middle of breeding season. Breeding season started in July and they're really out and about at the moment. So please be careful. Please look out when you're in anywhere where there's any vegetation and scan up and down the sides of roads to make sure that, you know, there's nothing coming out, not just a koala, anything, kangaroo, whatever. Just be very mindful that wildlife are out and about. I think the hardest part is 90% of the ones that get hit by cars or attacked by dogs tend to be really healthy animals because they're moving around more. So that's the loss of good breeding stock. And that's the biologist in me coming out, you know, you're losing good breeding stock, you know, and it's just awful. Oh, she was asleep. See, have a look at those injuries there. They're healing really well. So you can imagine what it was like when she first came in. They were very raw.
Meanwhile, all signs look good for Wazza and her recovery, even if she has used up some of her lives.
I think she's used up about half a dozen.
There's raking, there's joining, there's flush, there's weather strap. Weather strap is the one.
On a sunny day in Spring Hill, just outside Orange in central west New South Wales, a handful of home restoration enthusiasts have gathered to learn how to repoint brickwork. Buildings in this small village date back to the 1870s, and today's workshop is part of a series teaching residents how to maintain historic homes. Hello, I'm Luke Wong, and I'm here watching on as veteran bricklayer Chris Boris shares his knowledge and skills learnt over 45 years in the trade.
My father was a bricklayer. He came from Poland, and he came here with a couple of tools, and he finished up doing bricklaying.
What age did you start at?
Cleaning bricks, I started about 7 or 8, but I started at 22. Yeah, I started late, but I haven't looked back.
So what are you actually teaching the people here today out at Spring Hill?
Pointing up brickwork that's been eroded, the mud's eroded out, and just show them how to do it, the tools you need, and you don't need much, the right equipment, especially the old lime mortar, how it's done, how easy it can look, especially if they only got, you know, a dozen bricks or a small amount.
You get to work on quite a few heritage buildings and many buildings that are under heritage consideration. What does it feel like to be able to work on such old buildings and to see how they were actually built back in the old days?
Yeah, well every building's different, so it is. If you like your buildings, it's fascinating, yeah.
Alison and Peter Rogers volunteered a building on their property as the venue for the workshop. The couple's residence was once the village's police quarters, and it has a unique feature in the backyard, as Alison explains.
We've got a four-bedroom house and a cell block, a double cell block out the back, which still has one of the original cell doors on it. It's four bricks, three bricks thick. It's Bathurst bricks. Yeah, it's designed for sound and noise and light deprivation where they locked people up in there.
What do you know about the building's history in the sense of how long was it used for?
It was commissioned in, 1925, and I think 76 it was decommissioned as a cell block. But then the police were here till the mid-80s, early 90s, or mid-80s, using it as a forensics scientific lab type thing, the cell block itself, and then the police rented it out to locals after that until it was sold to the people that brought it before us.
And so you often get some people stopping by and asking about the actual building. Who comes along and actually asks about it?
We get a mixture of people. There is a heritage trail in Spring Hill, which is related to the grant that brings us all here today. So you do get your normal tourism coming through, but most interestingly we do have old residents, so police officers and police officers' children who spend a period of time here bringing their grandchildren just to show them where they lived and the lifestyle. You have to remember this was a horseback police station there originally, so no electricity and getting around and looking after the place on horseback, so the lifestyle here would have been quite varying to what we see today.
And Alison, what are you using the block for these days?
It's a spare bedroom. It's got a couple of beds in there. Visitors actually stay in there. Our son uses it when his friends come over and hang out in there.
Is your mother listening? It's a granny flat.
My granny flat. My mum, when she comes up, uses it as a granny flat as well.
And what's the state of the inside of it like these days? Is it like the cells of yesteryear?
No, it's painted and carpeted and actually got mattresses on beds, and there's none of the original furniture in there. And yeah, when we moved in, it was actually just concrete walls and the sloped floors where you can just go in and hose it all out. But now we've painted it up inside a bit.
And the ceiling would be quite high in it as well, is that right?
Yeah, it's really, really high, and it's timber slats.
Right.
Well, the construction, very sturdy, at least triple brick with a cavity in there. You couldn't get out of it, but it was also built, I think, so your mates couldn't get you out either. So you weren't going to escape, and no one was going to get you out. It's a very solid building. It's quite a building of significance, I think, but it is a bit of a secret. Not too many people are aware of it. I think it's a rare feature that we're very happy to have in our own backyard, and it's something that we're happy to be spending the time here today preserving.
You'll scrape it off, but you want it pretty much flush with the bricks, because then you're going to do your angling.
I'm going to do my angle, but I'm going to do reverse to that.
Yeah, okay.
30-year-old Stephen Scott jumped at the opportunity of a free crash course in brick repointing. He's hoping to apply the skills to his own home in nearby Orange.
So I've got an old Federation-style house that's about 100 years old, and like many old houses, has its old house issues, including a bunch of the mortars come out from bricks around the old stable. So wanting to just learn a little bit about it and being able to hopefully ideally do it myself and save myself a bit of money on a bricklayer.
What made you want to purchase a Federation house? I mean, with all the maintenance that's required with these types of houses.
I have a wife that likes old houses. It's probably the main answer. But I mean, I love the history of old houses too. And yeah, really, you get your old house issues, but you certainly get the character and stuff in them. The floorboards with, you know, shoe marks of decades of shoe marks on it, worn steps where people have walked for hundreds of years and stuff like that. You know, you just sort of seem to have a lot more character. And you know, really as well, you get the beautiful location right in the middle of town as well, rather than sort of being out in the suburban areas.
And thankfully, with the nicer weather, you're able to get into a bit of this while it's warming up.
Yeah, absolutely. It helps when you're not trying to do jobs in -4 degrees in the middle of the day type thing. You know, it makes it a little bit more enjoyable to do it that way.
Heritage homeowner and restoration enthusiast Stephen Scott. He was picking up some tips at a workshop on repointing old brickwork held in Central West New South Wales. That story by reporter Luke Wong. You're listening to Country Breakfast. Still to come, it's good news for pearl farmers as the gems make a comeback after some tough seasons on the Kimberley coast. And a most unusual school fundraiser that's attracting hunters from across the country to a small town in central Queensland.
The four-wheel drives roll into the Dingo racetrack one after the other, kicking up the dry brown dust that you can't escape in this part of central Queensland. They're loaded with feral pig carcasses, ready to be weighed in for a hunting competition that's being held for the very first time.
That is unbelievable.
Awesome. Well, this is our first go. Yeah. We're having a go.
You get all the ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
Hello, I'm Megan Hendry. I'm here at the racetrack with Louise Dunn. She's a local grazier and a teacher at the Dingo State School. It has about 50 students. Many come from nearby grazing properties that are struggling under the increasing weight of the drought.
We really needed this day. We really needed as a community to boost each other's, you know, morale. It is dry, we're all struggling, but a day like this is just positive all round.
She's also part of the school's PNC, which has organised the Dingo Hogs and Dogs inaugural pig hunting competition. It's a way to raise money for the school and at the same time help farmers battling the destructive feral pests.
We've got a crop in at the moment and the pigs are just smashing it. Our neighbour's got a little crop in and he said every day he can go down there and shot 180 pigs in the last 3 months off his crop. So they're just targeting anything that's green or alive. And then when it gets dry, of course, then they start to target the little animals and any eggs on the ground.
More than 200 hunters have come from as far as the Northern Gulf Country, the Gold Coast and even New South Wales to take part. There's prizes for the biggest boar, the heaviest sow the biggest tusks and the most colourful pig.
These people, if you put prizes in front of them, they're going to go and hunt earnestly, and they have.
Hundreds of pigs are being brought in to be weighed. Countless others are left out in the paddocks, too small to be competitive. Ian Pedrosini drove more than 7 hours from Charters Towers in North Queensland to compete. He used to make a living from hunting, but now it's a hobby and something he sees as a public service.
Well, I'm a grazier myself, so I've got every day, like they kill me calves, they wreck all me waterlands, we're on the Balliando River, they just tear, they've got, you have a look, there's all Parthenium, prickly acacia, gar seeds, Parkinsonia, they just walk the river systems, they travel, they're just spreading seed, you know, they just make a big mess.
He's brought in 9 feral pigs to be weighed, and early on is holding the top spot in 3 categories. The dogs are an important part of the hunt and of the competition day too. There's a prize for the ugliest pig dog, the biggest pig dog, and even a fancy dress pig dog parade. It's not really Ian's focus for the day, but he does love his dogs.
So I've got about 12. Try not to knock them around, so we go for a hunt, this one, and then they have a rest and another one. So I don't, yeah, stress them.
What makes a good pig dog?
Oh, well, discipline. They're all well trained. I've got my 4-year-old grandson. He feeds all the puppies. He raises them up. They're all raised by kids, so they're non-aggressive. Yeah, people say pig dogs are aggressive. They're not. They're well trained. It's the pig dogs that have been let go in town that aren't being worked that become aggressive. That's they're bred to hunt. They're bred to do what they love.
After 6 hours of weighing in, the carcasses are well and truly piling up. But there's not going to be much waste here. A front loader moves about 20 pigs at a time into the trailers of a B-double, parked a couple of hundred metres away. The truck is bound for the Corana Crocodile Farm near Rockhampton, about a 2.5-hour drive. The croc farm staff will process the carcasses into small packs of mince that will feed 1,000 baby crocodiles for more than 3 months. Back in Dingo, the sun has set, the presentations have been made, and the party has started.
Unbelievable. It's just been an absolute phenomenal response, and the community has really rallied behind. You know, just the planning and the camaraderie, getting this day together has just been brilliant. And you can see as you walk around the, you know, the smiles and the, you know, everyone likes to talk about the pig they got or the pig they missed or I've got the biggest hooks, and it's just all about building spirit and community.
These oysters were fished in 2017, and these particular ones are wild stock from down at the 80 Mile Beach. They were seeded a few months after that with their first nucleus and some donor tissue from a sacrificial oyster. And 2 years on, after a lot of meticulous care, and they're ready to be harvested.
At Willie Creek Pearl Farm, about 40 kilometres north of Broome in Western Australia's Kimberley region, the pearl harvest is ramping up. It's an exciting time as this farm prepares for its biggest ever commercial harvest.
They're all starting to relax and open up, and the boys here are going along and putting a doorstop kind of wedge into the oysters so that they remain open so the technicians can get inside and do the operation.
Hello, I'm Courtney Fowler. I'm here with the Pearl Farm's operations manager, Paul Birch. We're standing by some big tanks of water filled with cages of oyster shells. They look like they're taking a bath. Paul's about to show me the almost surgical process involved in harvesting each pearl.
What you're about to see, or what we're about to do, is really the first time this pearl has actually physically been seen by anyone. And if it's a good quality pearl and it meets the specifications, then we will put another nucleus back inside that same pearl sac, and that oyster can regrow another pearl ready in 2 years' time.
So the oysters are here in the bath. Obviously they need to be pulled out and for the surgery to take place. Should we take some out and see what we find?
Yeah, sure. Let's peg a few and then we can send them through to the techs and we'll jump on the tools and we can have a look inside.
You've got a lamp and you're pointing it into probably an inch of space, if that. And you've got these surgical tools. You look like you're literally performing surgery. And you're making a little incision in the reproductive organ of the oyster, and this is where we're going to find that pearl.
Yeah, exactly right. you know, the scalpels and everything we're using are surgical. It's a very small space, but when you know what you're looking for, you can certainly find it. Sometimes you can't see it, you can just feel it. So
it's not a lot of room to move with, is it?
No, it's a pretty small space. You can see here, we've got the muscle
yep.
that opens and closes the oyster so that it can feed, and then a bit of the intestinal loop there. And next to that, we've got the reproductive organ, which is where the pearl is located. And it's really as simple as making a small incision alongside the pearl that we're harvesting.
Waiting in anticipation.
Yeah. And this indication slowly but carefully. Wow, there you go. Look at that, perfect.
Amazing.
Round, near round, amazing luster, white with some pink hues.
And to the untrained eye, I mean, I think all the pearls look beautiful, but obviously the professionals, you're looking for a certain qualities in the pearl. Talk us through those qualities that you're after when you're pulling one of those pearls out of the oysters.
Pearls are valued or graded on five virtues: shape, size, complexion, luster and colour. They kind of equally all combine to give an ultimate value on the pearl or grade of the pearl. For me, it's about luster and colour.
And that one looks pretty shiny there, doesn't it?
Yeah, look, it's, you can almost see yourself. It's almost mirror-like, and then it's got some beautiful pink through it. It's certainly a trademark or hallmark quality of colour from this particular area where we're farming oysters. So, you know, that really increases the value. This is really a gem piece when it has that kind of colour through it. But yeah, the colour and the lustre on this are really what combines to give it an amazing set of qualities and value.
There's a lot in there.
Further up the Dampier Peninsula is one of Australia's oldest pearl farms, Signet Bay. Over the past decade, the farm have been trialling a range of methods to boost production, following a mystery disease which led to a widespread oyster shell mortality in the region. As I sit down with third-generation pearl farmer James Brown, he has a smile on his face as he tells me how they're starting to see the results of that work.
This is a hatchery shell that we spawned ourselves in our new hatchery in Signet Bay in 2013, right? Which then took a long time to grow to be big enough to seed, so about that 100mm mark. So we put them out in the farm at, you know, 2mm. It took us until 2017... to actually get them big enough to then seed. And this group is actually the group that we got those two gigantic round pearls out of early in the harvest, that the, you know, the 18.5mm pearls out of, and these are first pearls. So that means that they've grown from a kind of a 3mm nuclei to an 18.5mm pearl in 2 years. It's unbelievable. The way we then assess them from a very kind of analytical kind of approach is that we take the weights of our pearls as a whole harvest weight for that group, and then we divide it up per piece. And so that's the way pearlers talk. We talk about the average weight of a pearl in our entire crop. Now, what we're looking for is, and it's done in these weird Japanese terms, right? Because our international market is still dominated by the Japanese influence. So the pearls would normally go to Japan before they're dispersed. And there's a weight, a Japanese weight for pearls called momé. If we got a 0.6, 0.7 or 0.8 momé per piece for our crop of first pearls, that'd be a good result. Now, I'm so excited by this particular group. Even though it's a relatively small group, you can see there's probably only about, you know, 600 or 700 pearls here. It's a family group that we spawned two individual oysters. In 2013, we grew all the way through, and then we've kept them all the way through until the point they produced a pearl. And they've gone above 0.6. So they're heading back to that point where we need them to be to show that our farm is actually starting to become really productive again. So out of all the thousands of pearls that you can sort of see laying around the room here, this small group here is the bright, shiny kind of light of hope that the industry, you know, will actually come back. So I'm particularly proud of this group.
James Brown from Signet Bay Pearl Farm on the Dampier Peninsula in northern WA. He was speaking with reporter Courtney Fowler. Before that, Megan Hendry brought us the story of the town of Dingo in central Queensland, where a feral pig hunt has raised money for the local school. You can see pictures and video from that event if you really want to, and read more about those stories on our website, abc.net.au/radionational. You'll find Country Breakfast under the Programs tab.